the final image. Lichtenstein availed himself of the genres of comic books popular in the early 1960s, most famously romance comics and war comics. He used superhero comics panels most specifically twice. The first, Image Duplicator, from 1963, was based on a Jack Kirby illustration of Magneto from X-Men No. 1. The second, Mad Scientist, 1963, used a panel from a Justice League of America comic. One should also contend with Wham! From 1963, which was taken from a war comic, but did more to memorialize a comic book sound effect than anything before it. Lichtenstein was promiscuous in his use of previously published comic books. Rather than craft an original panel, he borrowed images from artists as prestigious as Kirby, Joe Kubert, Russ Heath, John Romita, and Mike Sikowski. The fact that Lichtenstein would take a comic book panel for which an artist was paid a fraction of, say, $15 a page, repurpose it and recomposite it, then sell it for hundreds of thousands of dollars a canvas, was an inequity that did not go unnoticed. It didn't help Lichtenstein's reputation among comic book artists and fans, yet he was quoted as saying, "The comics really haven't anything I would call art connected with it. They are really using a craft ability almost entirely, an artistic sense only slightly. There's composition connected with comic strips, but in a very superficial way." For the pop artists of the 1960s, the comic book conformed immediately to their purposes. They were mass-produced, they were resonant with nostalgia, they were already graphically appealing, they were pleasurable and popular. Pop art may have obliterated the narrative form of comic books by reproducing only one panel at a time, but it elevated the vocabulary of comic book art into fine art, or at very least a vibrant discussion about what constituted high art and low art. For the comic books themselves, if not for the repurposed artists, the emergence of pop art was a cultural windfall. Less than a decade after the Senate subcommittee debacle, comic book art was being talked and argued about in the most erudite art journals and newspaper columns. It would have been foolish for comic books not to ride the crest of this public relations bonanza. For a while, Marvel Comics even rebranded their comics as Pop Art Productions, whatever that meant, on their covers. Inevitably, pop art would be appropriated by the very genre it borrowed from initially. It would take a few visionary artists, Neil Adams and Jim Steranko, to name two, to reverse the polarity of pop art's electricity. They didn't create million-dollar canvases, but no comic book fan worth his or her salt would ever dream of parting with their works of art, even at 12 cents a pop. Reporting for duty. Captain America lives again. The term retcon has a military feel to it, like something Captain America might have done in some adventure. Cap and Bucky retconned the impenetrable fortress of the fiendish Red Skull. Retcon actually refers to retroactive continuity, a term that bubbled up at a comic book convention in the early 1980s, referring to the need to go back into the past to alter a narrative for the present. It's only fitting that Captain America was the first retconned character of the 1960s. Among his buddies from the timely days of the 1940s, Cap's erstwhile partners, the Human Torch and the Submariner, had already appeared on the new Marvel scene. But the Torch was a completely reinvented character, reconstituted as teenager Johnny Storm. The Submariner, for his part, hadn't really changed at all, swimming along in his usual antisocial manner. Captain America was the only major character left unexamined as the fateful fall of 1963 beckoned. On August 28, 1963, as Martin Luther King Jr. addressed the throngs gathered at the Mall in Washington, D.C., and by extension John F. Kennedy, who was listening at the White House, Strange Tales No. 114 hit the streets, with a cover story of young Johnny Storm fighting, quote, "out of the golden age of comics, Captain America." It was the first time that Jack Kirby had drawn his star-spangled creation in almost 2 decades. By the time the tale had concluded, readers were disappointed to learn that it wasn't Cap at all, but an imposter villain called the Acrobat. Still, Stan Lee, who had initiated and written the story, had used the Acrobat as a stalking horse. Would readers be interested in seeing the real Cap back in print? The answer was a resounding yes. But before Captain America could be launched in a new form, the vibrant young president who had become the new icon of America was assassinated in Dallas that November. At the Marvel Comics offices on Madison Avenue, all work stopped as the staff listened to the sad news on the radio. Within weeks, Stan Lee would begin to recreate Captain America for a nation in mourning, a nation that had lost a symbol of aspiration and youth, devoid of cynicism. If there were any doubts about the power of resurrection, they were dispelled in early 1964 on the cover of Avengers No. 4, which proudly displayed, "Captain America Lives Again." And there, rocketing toward the reader, was Captain America, as only Jack Kirby could render him, a powerhouse of patriotic passion. The mighty Marvel Comics group is proud to announce that Jack Kirby drew the original Captain America during the Golden Age of comics, and now he draws it again. Also, Stan Lee's first script during those fabled days was Captain America, and now he authors it again. Thus, the chronicle of comicdom turns full circle, reaching a new pinnacle of greatness. After that ennobling epigraph, the story spun into action. The Avengers, hot in pursuit of the Submariner up near the Arctic Circle, discover the submerged figure of a man floating in the sea, encrusted in ice. When Giant Man pulls the man inside their ship, they notice that his shield and mask could only belong to one person, Captain America. When he awakes, Cap thinks the Avengers are Nazi agents, but is eventually subdued and recounts his story. The last thing he remembers is fighting in World War II, side by side with his comrade Bucky. Against Cap's wishes, Bucky decides to defuse a bomber as a last-ditch effort and is effectively blown to smithereens. Captain America falls into the sea, where he drifts to the Arctic and is frozen in a state of suspended animation. Completely disoriented after his retrieval by the Avengers, he lashes out at them, but by the issue's conclusion, he accepts them as worthy comrades and joins the team, eventually becoming their leader off and on for the next 5 decades. The new narrative allowed Lee to redact the awkward Captain America adventures from the mid-1950s, when he'd grappled unconvincingly with communists. For Lee and Kirby, Cap's resurrection was fraught with both possibilities and obstacles. Kirby would, indeed, get the chance to tackle his creation again, this time with the formidable storytelling skills he had refined over 2 decades. Imagine Michelangelo, who sculpted his David while still in his 20s, getting the chance to return to the same subject after having completed the Sistine Chapel, a wiser, sadder man. Lee, who conveniently airbrushed Joe Simon out of the narrative, would also be returning to a character whom he could now imbue with irony and tragic dimension. The post-1964 appearances of Captain America in both the Avengers and his own exploits, published simultaneously in Tales of Suspense, focused on spectacular adventure, to be sure, but usually had some scene where an older cop, moved by the sight of his childhood hero, brushes away a tear, or where some World War II Army vet, now in his 40s, trades combat stories with the seemingly immortal Captain America. For 2 World War II Army veterans, recall that Kirby and Lee had to go into suspended animation from working on Captain America in the mid-1940s so they could fight the war, it must have been a gratifying way of recounting old war stories. Kirby, in particular, had some combat exploits he must have been eager to exercise. Cap himself was not so lucky. Tortured by the guilt of letting Bucky die in his stead, he moaned over his partner's demise to a point that was almost unseemly, He was sometimes in danger of becoming more like Dickens's Miss Havisham than a fearless champion of democracy. He took on another partner, a teenager named Rick Jones, who was usually pestering the Hulk instead, and groomed him to replace Bucky. Occasionally, Leon Kirby took a break from the modern-day hand-wringing and returned to some actual Captain America and Bucky tales from 1940, rewriting and redrawing them with greatly improved graphics and dimension. They seemed to revel in a return to the less politically ambiguous days of the battle against Hitler. But the revived Captain America's narrative potency came from his contemporary adventures. As comics historian Danny Fingeroth puts it, "Everybody else that Steve Rogers had known and loved is either dead or a quarter century older. He survived an era and survived a war where his peers didn't. There is some traumatized thing that I think Captain America hooked into, and Lee and Kirby were astute enough to understand that and really let it play out." Steve Rogers was, like his namesake Buck Rogers many decades before, a man literally out of his own time, always good for a compelling tale. But he was also the symbol of America. So what did that mean? Just as the country would attempt to regain its footing after Kennedy's death, so too did Captain America try to regain his footing after his own rebirth. Within the next decade, he would confront his own obsolescence and his country's at the same time. In one of Stan Lee's favorite lines, he had Marvel's greatest iconic character ponder his situation in a 1970 comic. "I've spent a lifetime defending the flag and the law. Perhaps I should have battled less and questioned more." The Second Generation, Jim Steranko. Jim Steranko burst on the scene in the mid-1960s. After a few false starts at other companies, he came to Marvel in 1966, where he was put on one of their worst-selling books, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Because there was little to lose, Steranko threw himself at the James Bond knockoff with, well, Unshielded Fury, bringing dozens of new innovations to the comic book page. His career at Marvel was brief, only 3 years, but unforgettable. Graphics historian Arlen Shumer put it this way. Many people consider Jim Steranko the Jimi Hendrix of comic book art in the late 1960s, because just like Hendrix, he came on like a comet, an overnight sensation. And just like Hendrix left in 1970, Steranko pretty much leaves comics for good in 1970, but creates a body of work whose influence and impact is in inverse proportion to the actual quantity of comics he turned out. Steranko himself.
"Our competition was superheroes who could fly, who could knock down walls, who had colorful costumes, really great. Here's a guy, all he had was a cigar butt and an eye patch, for God's sake. How do you compete? Well, I used all of these things. I used modern music. I used modern design. I used psychedelic art. I brought surrealism into the mix. I brought expressionism. I brought pop art, optical art. I used everything I could to update comics and bring them into today. And like I said, S.H.I.E.L.D. was very forgiving, and it allowed me to do that very easily. I did this 3-page silent sequence. And it began with Nick Fury penetrating an enemy fortress, this monolithic structure of stone. And he was climbing up, using some special tools, broke into the fortress, got down, and then the next 2 pages played out in a little scene where he gets killed at the end. But it was all done silently. And when I say silently, I mean there wasn't even a thought balloon. There wasn't even a caption. There were no words anywhere. 3 pages of silence for the first time in comics. I took it in and showed it to Stan. He went, oh, my God. I said, what's the matter? He said, don't you know what you did here? I said, why don't you tell me? He said, distributors and bookstores are going to think that this is misprinted, that we forgot the balloons and the captions. And I said, oh, give me a break, will you? But you know, he was probably right about that in a certain way. Well, we had a little fight about it. I thought I was bringing a new concept, something really different to the House of Ideas, but I was getting rejected at the same time. So we had a little brawl about it, and that one I happened to win. So I took the pages into production, where Saul Brodsky, Hal Court, and Saul looked over the story, which I think was a 20-pager, and he said, I can't pay you for writing these first three pages. There's nothing here, so I can only pay you for 17. Now look, the pages were written. Creating a sequence that could be understood easily without dialogue, without thought balloons, or without captions takes real writing skill. It's all done visually. The writing is there. But when he said he couldn't pay me for it, I hit the roof. We were on the 8th floor. I grabbed this guy by his shirt, and I said, I'm going to throw you out this window if you don't pay me for those three pages. I swear to God, you're going to be out in Madison Avenue in a moment. Well, in his infinite wisdom, he decided to pay me for the three pages, and we were cool about it. And those three pages, by the way, were imitated subsequently over and over again in the history of comics, including 1 month at Marvel, where every book was silent. So I kind of felt justified in creating that sequence.
Holy zeitgeist, Batman. The dynamic duo on TV. In his 9-decade history, Batman could always be relied upon to use his bat ingenuity to get himself out of an infinite number of death traps. His most remarkable escape gimmick would turn out to be a 12-inch color TV screen. Although Marvel Comics was publishing exciting exhumations of 1940s characters in the early 1960s, the distinguished competition was having a tough time keeping the second of their two major characters commercially viable. According to DC artist Carmine Infantino, Batman's titles were selling about 20% each month. The Caped Crusader had lost his way, completely unmoored from his original intention. Batman and Robin, that most unique of comic book duos, had become generic superheroes, plopped down in any situation, science fiction, monster movies, comedy. The only mystery left in Batman was why National even bothered to keep him in print. Infantino recounts that he and writer John Broom were called into editor Julie Schwartz's office in 1963, as Schwartz brandished a couple of poorly selling Batman issues at him. You two have 6 months to bring him back, or he's dead. Finished. Schwartz suggested that the team bring Batman back to his detective roots, jazz up the covers, maybe even jazz up Batman. Infantino was the right man on the National staff for the job, adding a yellow bullseye around Batman's forlorn bat insignia, and creating covers that intrigued and tantalized readers, beginning with Detective Comics number 327 in May of 1964. Sales picked up, but whether or not these cosmetic changes alone, called the new look, would have restored Batman to his anointed spot on the comic book Olympus is a question rendered moot by a series of decisions made a continent away in Hollywood. Television demographics were shifting in the mid-1960s. More families had color television sets, and executives were looking for programs that might bridge the divide between kiddie shows and grown-up shows, moving toward what would eventually be called family shows. Programs with bizarre and fantastical characters began to litter the primetime broadcast landscape. My Favorite Martian, The Addams Family, The Munsters were all appealing to youngsters. But there hadn't been a comic book hero on the air since Adventures of Superman called it a day in 1958. 2 years later, George Reeves was infamously found shot in his bedroom under still mysterious circumstances. Perhaps his tragic end cast a long shadow over enthusiasm to revive a superhero for television. ABC executives thought that comic strip crime buster Dick Tracy might make a suitable addition to the primetime lineup, but, outbid in a preemptive strike by NBC, they reached a bit further down into the pile and came up with Batman. There's a bit of murkiness about how the idea of the Batman character came to the attention of the programming directors at ABC. Rumor had it that Hugh Hefner had been running the old 1940s Batman serials for laughs over at the Playboy Mansion. But nonetheless, by early 1965, ABC had jobbed out the series to 20th Century Fox to produce a pilot. Veteran producer William Dozier was tasked with developing the character for television and flew to New York to meet with the ABC top brass. Dozier apparently took the meeting on faith, knowing nothing about Batman or comic books. He grabbed a handful of Batman comics to read on the transcontinental flight, burying the covers deep in his attaché case so as not to be mocked by his fellow first-class passengers. Dozier thought he was in over his head, until it occurred to him that, quote, "the idea was to overdo it. If you overdid it, I thought it would be funny to adults and yet would be stimulating to kids. But you had to appeal on both levels or you didn't have a chance." Dozier hired Lorenzo Semple Jr. to draft the pilot episode. Semple delivered with a story highlighting a minor comic book adversary called the Riddler. The story equally balanced comedy and adventure, making Batman into an incontrovertibly stolid pillar of civic virtue, in other words, a square, devoted to maintaining law and order in the vaguely unhinged swinging 60s. Dozier set his staff and crew to recreating the Batman universe for color television from the ground of the Batcave up. Costumes, sets, props, and a working Batmobile would be designed with unprecedented imaginative freedom. Even the music for the show, scored and arranged by Nelson Riddle, Frank Sinatra's favorite arranger, was hip, jazzy, and unexpected. Finding the face behind the cowl would be a challenge. The television Batman had to be suitably heroic, yet have a comic touch, and, much of the time, the actor's face would be obscured by an inflexible, silk-covered mask. Luckily, actor Adam West got the joke right off. A reliable player in various adventure and detective series and films, West was about to leave the country to make a spaghetti western when he was called in to read for Dozier. West doubled over with laughter reading Semple's script, and supposedly that was all the producer needed to know. West was signed to play Bruce Wayne. Youthful ward Dick Grayson proved harder to find, but at the last minute, an inexperienced actor with some karate training named Burton Jervis walked onto the Fox lot. He fit the bill admirably, and soon Burt Ward, as he would now be known, completed the dynamic duo. West reveled in the challenge of creating TV's first superhero of the 1960s. In the comic books, Batman was lighthearted, and he cracked wise from time to time. Now all I had to do was expand on that. But I wanted to let people watching know that anyone pretty much could become Batman, or become someone admirable, by doing good in the world. And that's kind of the way I played it for the kids. The pilot episode was filmed in October of 1965 and spotlighted the impressionist and actor Frank Gorshin in a career-making performance as the Riddler. His contorted paroxysms in the part would earn him an Emmy nomination. ABC executives made the inventive decision to split the hour-long show in two parts every week, providing a cliffhanger for audiences, and began screening the pilot episode to focus groups. Although Batman tested so poorly that the marketing department was convinced that the reaction monitors were broken, ABC and Dozier kept the faith and ordered 16 weeks of the two-part weekly program for a January 1966 debut, smack in the middle of the traditional television season. Everything on the program, from its eccentric camera angles, to its saturated color palette, to its melodramatic voiceovers, to the pop art title cards that punctuated each knockdown drag-out fight with pow and zonk to the ranks of underemployed character actors from the 1940s and 50s who were knocking over themselves to show up on the program costumed as freakish supervillains. Everything had been conceived with originality and underwritten with a generous budget to create a vibrant video equivalent of a comic book. Besides, as the third network, usually consigned to the ratings basement, ABC had nothing to lose but its conventionality. Batman debuted on Wednesday, January 12, 1966, with the first half of the Riddler pilot episode broadcast at 7:30 p.m., a perfect time slot to capture both youngsters and their parents. Overnight, it became, quite simply, one of the great pop culture phenomena of the 1960s. As Adam West put it, it was the Beatles, Bond, and Batman. By the time Batman had broadcast its first 34 adventures in late spring of 1966, the Thursday night episodes were ranked number 5 in the Nielsen ratings, and the Wednesday night episodes were number 10. No show had ever had two weekly episodes in the top 10. Batmania gripped the nation, and in March of 1966, Batman, in the guise of Adam West, became the first superhero to grace the cover of Life magazine. Even the Batman comic books, perilously close to extinction only 2 years earlier, were now selling in the millions. Batman also hit the marketplace in a manner that far outpaced even Superman at his height. It was an unprecedented Bat Bazaar. Part of this was the nature of the show itself.
We were everywhere and on twice a week in color. It was different. So immediately, you know, the marketing, merchandising departments got into the act, of course, and all kinds of things were created as a reflection of the show. And it was an easier thing than most shows because Batman, Robin, the others, we had props. We had props up the wazoo. I mean, anywhere you looked on the set, there was a prop that I could use, or set dressing, or something. It was really fun to fool with, you know?
Marketing expert Ed Cato reflects that the show was, quote, a game changer that brainwashed an entire generation of kids, myself included. It had this crazy vibe that no one had seen before. Batman has so many tools and toys and gadgets and friends and villains, and all those things are just ripe for licensing. So by Christmas of 1967, all these little boys got Batmobiles under the Christmas tree, and Batman figures and Batcapes and Batarangs. The television series succeeded beyond ABC's wildest dreams of unifying a children's audience and an adult audience. It was the first time in media history that all generations could sit around the living room and enjoy a superhero saga. For kids, the derring-do appeal was obvious. For adults, Batman offered a window into some of the more complicated cultural conflicts of the 1960s. Pop art made several appearances, including one where the Clock King, a criminal actually borrowed from a Green Arrow comic, masquerades as Progress Pigment, the true apostle of pop art, in an episode written by none other than Bill Finger, Batman's co-creator. Batman's comic book origins were confined to one throwaway line in the first episode, where Bruce Wayne refers to the, quote, dastardly criminals who murdered my parents. But the character became an effective spokesman for civic virtues and Victorian respectability in an anxious time. Batman championed the use of safety belts, studying your homework, a refreshing glass of milk, and following the straight and narrow. The Batman series could pivot on a dime into satirical commentary. In one episode, the nefarious Penguin decides to run for mayor so that he can pilfer the Gotham City treasury. When the Caped Crusader tosses his cowl into the ring against the Penguin, he decides to run, quote, a nice clean campaign, without vaudeville tricks. After all, Robin, the public is interested in the issues. Of course, it turns out to be the dullest political campaign in Gotham City history. Not everyone was thrilled with Batman's transition into a stuffy, caped prism of contemporary sensibilities. Denny O'Neil, who would go on to create groundbreaking comic book scenarios for Batman in the 1970s, said, "The Batman TV show was pretty much a one-line joke. I loved this stuff when I was 6 years old, and now that I'm 27 and I have a closet full of Nehru jackets and a twice-weekly appointment with a therapist and a little tiny drug habit, look how silly it is." In New York, you would go to the most literary bar in the city, the White Horse Inn, on one of the 2 days that they had the Batman shows on, and the cream of village intelligentsia, at least the ones who liked to go to bars, were looking at that show behind the bar. However, as the villain Bookworm might have quoted Shakespeare, so do quick, bright things come to confusion. The highly anticipated second season of Batman debuted in fall of 1966 with even more overacted and underbaked villains, poorer scripts, and strained sensibilities. None of its episodes landed in the top 20. For the third season, the budgets were slashed and the episodes scaled back to once a week. But even the addition of the sassy Batgirl failed to provide enough engines to power or turbines to speed. 120 episodes later, Bat Time had officially come to an end. West, who has reveled in his iconic presence for 6 decades now, is philosophical. "I think of our Batman as the Bright Knight. The kids loved it, and we were funny for the adults, and that was our intention. If you play it that way, the show stays fresh and always kind of spinning around out there in its own little world, and people get into it once they get past 3 or 4 years of age." Or, as Commissioner Gordon put it, 5 minutes into the first Batman episode, speaking for television executives, comic book executives, and 11-year-old boys alike, "I don't know who he is behind that mask of his, but we need him, and we need him now." Parody and satire. When William Gaines stomped away from the proceedings of the Comics Code Authority in 1954, turning his back on the successful publishers of superhero comic books, he was no doubt plotting his revenge. The revered saying, "Living well is the best revenge," might have been revised by Gaines as, "Laughing well is the best revenge." The one successful comic book that Gaines had left in his portfolio was an anarchic four-color parody magazine called Mad. Mad would eventually gain a storied reputation for satirizing just about every aspect of American culture worth mocking, which is to say, most of American culture, as a black-and-white magazine beyond the reach of the code in 1955. But the early, crazy issues of the Mad comic book displayed a particular animus toward its colleagues in the funny pages and comic books. Superheroes had been rather gently but rarely satirized since they arrived on the scene. There might be some jokes at, say, Superman's expense on the Fred Allen radio show. Actual parody came in 1942, with the cartoon shorts featuring Mighty Mouse, who originally began as Super Mouse. Even before that, the Terry Toon Studio thought of creating a super-powered housefly called, wait for it, Superfly. But it might be fair to say that in the 1940s and 50s, superheroes weren't taken seriously enough to satirize. The usual gang of idiots at Mad changed all that. In the fourth issue, 1953, Mad took on both the Shadow and Superman, who was exquisitely rethought as Super Duperman. Harvey Kurtzman, who wrote the spoof, and Wally Wood, a tremendous artist who would render beautiful work on serious superhero comics in the 1960s, tapped right into the essential improbabilities of the hero, from Lois Lane derogating Clark Kent as a creep, to Super Duperman's fight to the finish with Captain Marbles, a rival superhero with a dollar sign on his chest and possessed of a magic word, Shazoom, in which the M stood for money. 4 issues later, The same team tackled the Caped Crusaders as a pint-sized Bat Boy and his gangly sidekick Reuben, chasing down a suspected vampire criminal. The final panel revealed that it was Bat Boy all along who possessed the real fangs and knew how to use them. Woman, Wonder, in Mad Number 10, undermined the basic premise of Wonder Woman. Her boyfriend, Steve Trevor, had no intention of her being more powerful than he, and he was particularly pleased to catch a glimpse of Woman Wonder changing into her costume inside her invisible plane. The Mad parodies were not only clever, they were perceptive. They knew how to get inside the character's basic absurdities in order to turn them inside out. When Batman debuted on national television in 1966, Mad weighed in almost immediately with Batsman, in which Sparrow, the Boy Wonderful, disguises himself as a villain in order to knock off Batsman, so he can finally hang up his cape and date girls and sniff airplane glue like all the other teenagers in Gotham City. That issue, number 183, was billed as, quote, the special summer camp issue, referring to a cultural phenomenon that had excited literary circles 2 years before the television show premiered. Susan Sontag had published her influential essay, Notes on Camp, in the Partisan Review in 1964, attempting to give coherence to a disparate set of aesthetic sensibilities that she identified in 58 separate markers. Although Sontag only mentioned comic books once, in a passing note about old Flash Gordon comics, her comments about science fiction films could be equally well applied to superheroes. The reason books like Winesburg, Ohio, and For Whom the Bell Tolls are bad to the point of being laughable, but not bad to the point of being enjoyable, is that they are too dogged and pretentious. They lack fantasy. There is camp in numerous Japanese science fiction films, such as Rodan, The Mysterians, The H-Man, because, in their relative unpretentiousness and vulgarity, they are more extreme and irresponsible in their fantasy, and therefore touching and quite enjoyable. Although it was hard to know when the term was being applied accurately or not, camp became a convenient label among critics, and the television version of Batman appeared to be a poster child for a sensibility that, in Sontag's definition, incarnates a victory of style over content, aesthetics over morality, of irony over tragedy. Apparently, there was no sillier occupation than being a superhero. But since superheroes took it all so seriously, the whole enterprise couldn't possibly be serious. It must be silly. Defining something as camp was also a way for folks with heightened sensibilities to enjoy superheroes or comic books without having to admit they actually enjoyed them. Whether they were technically camp or simply exhaustingly derivative, there was a wave of satirical superheroes after Batman appeared. Exactly a year after Batman's debut, network television immediately came up with two witless parodies, Captain Nice on NBC and Mr. Terrific on CBS, which premiered on the same night and were also canceled on the same night 5 months later. ABC decided to play it straight by hiring William Dozier to produce The Green Hornet. It too was a flop, but it was effective crime drama. Underdog and Adamant had preceded Batman on Saturday morning television, but soon other animated spoofs, Batfink, Frankenstein Jr. and the Impossibles, Super Chicken, joined the kiddie lineup. Comic book publishers, no fools they, saw the commercial possibilities in biting the fans that fed them. Marvel put out a parody anthology devoted to superheroes called Not Bren Ech, referring to DC, with their own mascot, Forbishman. DC countered with The Inferior Five, a hapless quartet who were the grown-up children of parody versions of the DC pantheon. There were also dozens of funny superhero comics from lesser publishers. The inimitable Mad Magazine artist Don Martin turned in an amusing paperback book character called Captain Klutz, whose unforgettable alias was Ringo Phonebone. Perhaps the oddest of this odd lot was The Great Society Comic Book, a 1967 one-off parody published by an independent company that recast the Johnson administration as superheroes. The president himself was Super LBJ, and his nemesis were not supervillains, but the fraternal hero team of Bob Mann and Teddy, the Kennedy brothers, recast as pretenders to LBJ's seat in the White House. As long as superheroes run around at night in their underwear and tights, they will always be targets for parody. Most of the side swipes are obvious, but a few are so perceptive that they stand a good chance of living on as long as their inspirations. Saturday Night Live's animated parody of Batman and Robin, the ambiguously gay duo, is like a Frederick Wortham nightmare come true. And the geriatric pair of aquatic heroes on SpongeBob SquarePants, Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy, not only head dunk every cliche about undersea heroes, their comic book adventures are drawn by none other than Ramona Freyden, the glorious artist of Aquaman's golden and silver age of comics. Imitation is clearly the sincerest form of parody. Sweet Christmas. Black powerhouses. When the Marvel Universe coalesced around Manhattan, it was inevitable that one day they would wake up to recognize that New York City contained the largest black population in the United States. With the exception of the music world, African Americans had traditionally been underrepresented in popular culture, but the world of comic books was perhaps the slowest genre to recognize blacks in any meaningful form. By the early 1940s, there were black stars on Broadway, black musicians on the song charts, even an African American winner of an Academy Award. But as stereotypical as Hollywood portrayals of black characters could be, they seemed practically enlightened by comic book standards. When comic books deigned to portray black characters at all, they were usually gullible, inarticulate sidekicks, caricatured physically as well as culturally, with names like Whitewash Jones or Ebony White, the cab-driving sidekick of the Spirit. According to comics historian Gerard Jones, some beautiful stories by Will Eisner about the Spirit are to some extent forever marred by his caricatured black sidekick. As Marvel Comics moved into the 1960s, the hermetically sealed comic book world would slowly open up. Jack Kirby, who was drawing most of Marvel's cityscapes, occasionally inserted a black spectator pointing up at the Fantastic Four's Baxter Building, for example. A World War II comic, created by Kirby and Stan Lee, Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos, which debuted in 1963, featured a black commando named Gabriel Jones, although the printing plant was so surprised to see a black character that they accidentally colored him white in the first issue. A 1964 Captain America adventure has Cap venturing behind enemy lines into North Vietnam to rescue a downed black pilot. Over at the Spider-Man book, artist John Romita gave J. Jonah Jameson, an African-American editor at the Daily Bugle, named Joseph Robbie Robertson, in 1967. "There was a time when I realized we don't really have any black characters," said Stan Lee. "I felt we should be representative of the whole world. Every type of person should be represented in these stories." The first major black superhero appeared in the pages of Fantastic Four number 52, which would have hit the stands in late spring 1966, 9 months after the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the horrendous devastation of the Watts riots. The hero was the completely masked Black Panther, a lithe, mysterious figure who summoned the Fantastic Four to a jungle kingdom in Africa called Wakanda. After outwitting the team, the Panther pulls back his mask to reveal that he is the African chief T'Challa, whose kingdom owns a mine of vibranium, a rare metal that is the source of their great wealth and astonishing technical expertise. Unfortunately, the vibranium renders Wakanda vulnerable to looters and poachers, one of whom murdered T'Challa's father, the previous Black Panther. The Panther was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, who had conceived an earlier black character, the Cole Tiger, that never made it to the starting gate. Introducing a black superhero busted down enough doors to begin with. But the subtle twist in the two Black Panther issues was the depiction of Wakanda as the most enlightened and tech-savvy country in the world. Even the cynical Feng, who yawns that he has, quote, seen this jungle stuff in the movies before, is suitably impressed with the tiny African nation before he returns back home. Intentionally or not, the character was packed with several conflicting themes from African-American culture, dating all the way back to the early 20th century, when activists, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, were trying to define the role of blacks within a larger social structure. Writer Gary Phillips frames the issue.
There's always that tension of pop culture in terms of uplifting the race, of showing the best and having you know, the one example, that one true example. And so in a lot of ways, Panther exemplifies that. And oddly enough, I think he's really sort of this, he is the noble savage. So on one hand, he's this king of this hidden African kingdom in Africa, Wakanda. And yet it's not the African kingdom we've read in Tarzan or any of those other kinds of pulp stories where people just run around with spears or what have you. In fact, it's a scientifically advanced kingdom, and it's purposely hidden itself from the world so as to avoid a lot of the conflicts and racism that have taken place certainly on the African continent.
The Panther would bestride both continents as a fixture in the Marvel Universe from 1966 on, earning several different versions of his own title and becoming a loyal member of the Avengers for decades. He ran into some public relations problems when the Black Power group devoted to social revolution, called the Black Panther Party, emerged out of Oakland a few months after the character's comic book debut. The two occurrences were completely unrelated. At one point, the character changed his name to the Black Leopard, but, realizing he wasn't fooling anyone, changed it back. "I did not want my personal goals and tribal heritage confused with political plans made by others. I am not a stereotype. I am myself. And I am the Black Panther." Ironically, the character far outlasted the political party, which was dissolved by 1982. African-American comic book fans were still waiting for a hero of their very own. Marvel artist Gene Colan nudged Stan Lee into creating a rival character for Captain America called the Falcon. A social worker in Harlem, with a gift for remarkable telepathy with a falcon named Redwing, Sam Wilson donned his own pin-feathered costume and became the Falcon in 1969. By 1971, the Falcon was Cap's full-time partner, and, thanks to some Wakandan technology, he eventually gained the power to fly on his own steam. Alas, there wasn't enough technology to make him a particularly interesting character. Luckily, in spring of 1972, the blaxploitation movement in films and music had opened another opportunistic door in the Marvel Universe. In the early 1970s, when Marvel was undergoing a feverish expansion, new characters usually appeared first in showcase comics, but Luke Cage, hero for hire, was given his own eponymous magazine right off the bat. The time was right for a streetwise, gritty black hero. With Roberta Flack, Al Green, and the OJs topping the charts, and the black detective film Shaft earning back 7 times its original investment, and with Superfly about to open, even mainstream white teenaged readers were ready to embrace Luke Cage. In homage to Captain America, a stubborn black prisoner named Carl Lucas, stuck in an impenetrable penitentiary where he is constantly victimized by white guards, agrees to participate in a strength enhancement experiment in exchange for parole. When the experiment goes horribly awry, he is transformed into a being of incredible power and invulnerability. Lucas escapes from prison, returns to Harlem, and reinvents himself as Luke Cage, hero for hire, a superpowered mercenary, complete with business cards and a costume with a huge chain for a belt, just in case anyone might miss the symbolism. "Yeah, outfit's kinda hokey," Cage admits, "but so what? All part of the superhero scene." Reading those early Luke Cage comic books, you can almost hear the soundtrack of Isaac Hayes or Curtis Mayfield playing in the background, writes comics historian Bradford Wright. Cage would be part of the superhero scene for the next 5 decades, undergoing various transformations. He was Power Man for a while, but still an essential lodestar for different groups and titles, including the Avengers. Actor Nicolas Cage has said that he changed his name from Coppola in honor of the character, but the character's greatest contribution was representing a real African-American superhero that spoke to all audiences, even though it was a risky choice to render him as an unapologetic troubleshooter who charged for his services. Gary Phillips recalls that the Panther was, quote, all regal wisdom and graceful power, the Sidney Poitier of the Marvel Universe. Luke Cage was street savvy, stubborn, and built for hellacious mayhem. Jim Brown without the referees. DC Comics was much slower to enfranchise black heroes and characters. According to comics historian William Foster, Marvel was the young maverick, so they could make changes. They could move quickly. They were like a speedboat. Unlike DC Comics, which was more like an aircraft carrier, they couldn't maneuver as easily with the changing times. In 1968, up-and-coming writer Marv Wolfman attempted to add a black superhero named Joshua to the Teen Titans comic book, but for reasons never completely confirmed, the character didn't make it out of the starting gate. DC tried with some one-off stories, the most remarkable of which was the episode in the November 1970 issue of Superman's Girlfriend, Lois Lane, number 106, I Am Curious Black. Written by DC veteran scribe Robert Kaniger, the issue borrows heavily from the 1961 nonfiction book Black Like Me, where a white writer tints his face so that he can pass as a black man in the American South. In the comic book, our intrepid lady reporter is moved to better understand the tensions in Little Africa, Metropolis's answer to Harlem. Lois seeks Superman's help, who obliges her with an effective, but presumably little-used, device from his home planet Krypton that can turn white-skinned people black for 24 hours. During her one-day adventure, the dark-hued Lois Lane does in fact do her bit for racial equality and brotherhood, but in the end, she is a little more concerned whether Superman would still love her if she were black. DC's more effective commitments to African-American characters included John Stewart, a black architect who was selected by the Guardians to become Green Lantern's understudy in 1972, as well as characters such as Black Lightning and Cyborg. In the early 1980s, comic book writer and editor Roy Thomas lamented, "You could get blacks to buy comics about whites, but it was hard to get whites to buy comics in which the main character was black." But even with a slow start, the comic book industry has eventually embraced the possibilities inherent in multiracial characters. The results are imperfect. Hollywood movies, and to a lesser degree, television programs, also still wrestle with how to place African-American characters, along with other races and ethnicities, at the center of their mainstream narratives. But there is no denying that in the late 1960s and early 70s, it was the Black Panther and Luke Cage who kicked the door down. Writer Gary Phillips recalled,
"When I was a kid growing up in South Central, because in those days, and this is like in the 60s and on into the early 70s when I went into high school, you know, you kind of considered a chump and a sissy if you were reading DC Comics in those days. And so Marvel was where it was at, not only because you had the Hulk and Spider-Man, and they had their own, you know, angst and worries and what have you. But, of course, it was the fact that you had black superheroes showing up.
All new, all now. The Adventures of Captain Relevant. As the 1960s turned into the 1970s, there were a variety of problems facing the American people. The war in Vietnam, urban poverty, street riots, assassinations, a devolution of law and order, but perhaps only one directly confronted a comic book reading teenager at the time. Drugs. The counterculture of the 1960s had embraced marijuana and hallucinogens as part of their creed, but more powerful narcotics were entering the illegal marketplace, especially heroin. A Senate committee revealed that 10 to 15% of American combat troops were addicted to heroin. The government had just backed the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act of 1970, which tightened the medical supply lines, and President Nixon had declared that illegal drugs were public enemy number one. Hadn't comic book superheroes been created to fight public enemies? The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare evidently thought so. Early in 1970, Stan Lee received a letter from a representative in the government agency. As Lee remembered, it was something like, "Recognizing the influence that your character Spider-Man has on young people, we think it would be very beneficial if you would do an anti-drug story in Spider-Man." Well, no kid wants to be lectured to, so I wasn't about to do a story that said, "Don't take drugs." The story that Lee did come up with, illustrated by Gil Kane, was a three-part series that began in The Amazing Spider-Man number 96 and focused mainly on his archenemy, the Green Goblin. While Spidey is swinging across the city, he saves a young black man, perched precariously on a rooftop, obviously strung out on drugs. "I had never taken drugs, so I know nothing about them," Lee admitted. "I just wrote that he overdosed on something." The story arc was smart enough to leave that issue alone for a while, as Spider-Man pursued the Green Goblin, only to discover his roommate, Harry Osborn, who is actually also the son of the Green Goblin's alter ego, is also pill-popping a combination of uppers and downers, stuck between helping his friend battle his addiction and battling the Green Goblin himself. Spider-Man resolves the conflict neatly by the third issue of the series. Would that Lee and Marvel Comics could have resolved the conflict with the Comics Code Authority quite so easily. When Lee and his publisher, Martin Goodman, submitted the three-issue story arc to the Code Office for approval in June of 1970, it was summarily rejected. In Lee's recounting of the discussion,
"They said you're not allowed to mention drugs in the comics. I said, but we're not telling the kids to take drugs. It's an anti-drug message. Sorry. I said, but we were asked to do this by the office of HEW in Washington. Sorry."
While the story languished in the limbo of the Code Office, a parallel development was occurring over at DC Comics. It involved two superheroes on the verge of extinction and a pair of young comic book creators who shared a visionary sense of comic books' possibilities. Denny O'Neill was a former journalist from the Midwest, and Neil Adams was a former advertising artist. They were both of the first generation that had grown up reading comics to enter the field, and they had secured a berth at DC Comics in the mid-1960s, where they had worked together to get Batman back on his feet after the cancellation of the television show. In summer of 1970, O'Neill was called into the office of editor Julie Schwartz and was told that both Green Lantern and Green Arrow were about to be canceled, and, as a last-ditch effort, he was going to combine them into one title. The only real rationale for combining the swashbuckling Green Arrow and the space-age Green Lantern was that they shared a nominative color. O'Neill thought the only way to make sense of this shotgun marriage was to take it all in a completely new direction. "What if we plotted the stories from the headlines?" O'Neill asked. "What if we did the stuff that as U.S. citizens and veterans and fathers we were really concerned about? So I don't know how detailed a plot I gave Julie for that first one, but we agreed on a direction and a story, and then I went home writing and thinking that the usual Green Lantern artist would get the art assignment." Green Lantern Green Arrow number 76 wasn't much of a story, but it had a hell of a premise. Green Lantern flies through an urban ghetto to stop an apparent beating in progress, only to discover that his old pal, Green Arrow, is on the other side of the angels. The victim is an avaricious landlord. Green Arrow lectures Green Lantern that he has spent too much time fighting mad scientists in outer space to see the evil right in front of him in the real world. The point is driven home by a scruffy, aged black man who lives in the landlord's tenement. He encounters Green Lantern and asks, "I've been reading about you, how you work for the Blueskins, and how on a planet someplace you helped out the orange skins. And you done considerable for the purple skins. Only there's one skins you never bothered with.